Well, I would like to welcome everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the RPM sub-team for Trademark Claims Data Review Call on the 24th of April, 2019. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call. We have quite a few participants on the line. Attendance will be taken via the Zoom room. So if you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now? All right. Hearing no names, as a reminder to everyone, if you would please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. To mute your line today, unmute the bottom portion of the screen. You'll go to the bottom left corner. You'll see mute and unmute, as Julie said earlier. And to make sure you turn your video off as well, you'll see a red line through it, and that will make sure your video is off. And to toggle between the two screens today, between Ariel and Julie today, you'll go to the top of your screen. It says View Options. If you click on the drop-down arrow, you'll see shared screens, and then see Ariel's name, then Julie. You can toggle between the agenda and the document that is being shared. All right, at this time, I'll turn the meeting back over to Julie Hedlund. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle, and this is Julie Hedlund from staff, but I see that Greg has his hand raised. Greg, please go ahead.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. Just I wanted to note, based on what was just being said, that users on tablets and other mobile devices cannot toggle between screens. They will only see the first, whatever is considered to be the first screen at any given time, and I'm on a tablet, so if there's any toggling going on, I won't be able to toggle unless the other screen, the first screen is dropped, and then the second screen becomes the only active screen. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Well, in that case, perhaps particularly for you to be able to follow along today, you know, I can go ahead and stop sharing once we switch over to Ariel's document. There's no reason for people to watch the note-taking in real time. It's very minimal as it is. So thank you for that. This is Julie Hedlund again from staff. And I see, okay, thank you for the thumbs up, Greg. So just to quickly run through the agenda, we've got review the agenda and updates to statements of interest, a note about the timing of the next meeting, then the development of preliminary recommendations and review of individual proposals. That would be the draft answers for recommendations for Q1 and review proposals for 5 and 6. And then again, AOB, a reminder concerning the next meeting, just for those who may not be on the call at the beginning. And let me just go to agenda item 1 and ask if there are any updates to statements of interest. Not seeing any hands or any chat. Then going to agenda item 2. So the meeting next week has been moved. It is not on Wednesday, May 1st. It has moved to Tuesday, the 30th, at this same time. That is because the ICANN offices and many community members have a holiday on the 1st of May. So the U.S. offices of ICANN and several of the European offices are closed, and we also know that many community members will be off. So we have switched the call to the same time on 1700 UTC on Tuesday, 30 April. And Kathy Kleiman, please go ahead. Kathy, if you're speaking, we can't hear you. I see you are muted. Let me unmute you. You are unmuted. Okay. Please go
ahead.
Can
you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Did not realize you had to do that. Okay, so this is Kathy. I'm speaking as a member of the sub-team, not as a co-chair. First, I didn't know about this, and second, I object. I don't know about others, and I'd love to know, but I have commitments all day on Tuesdays, and so I think we should bump to another, you know, we've been doing Wednesdays for years now. And so given the importance of the work that we're doing, I think it would be valuable to stay on our schedule and stay with the time and the day of the week that's been working. So I thought I'd see if other people also have conflicts on Tuesday. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. I see Christine is noting she has a, and Susan also has a conflict. I don't know if there would be conflicts. I think there might be conflicts for Thursday the 2nd, and we don't have the liberty of skipping a week given our schedule. Let me just ask if there aren't, well, the main question would be whether or not we have, if we moved to Thursday the 2nd, whether or not we would have participation from the chairs, the co-chairs of the subteam, because we did have to confirm their availability and they are available on the 30th of April. And so I have, let me just do this because we don't really have that many people on this call. I don't know that we have participation from all of the subteam members. What we'll do quickly after this call is ask if there are conflicts if we move to the 2nd, but that will we will first have to look and see whether or not there are conflicts with any other community meetings. And we will also have to ascertain whether or not the subteam co-chairs are available to chair at least one of them on the 2nd. And I see two hands up, but I'm going to go to Roger first as one of the subteam co-chairs. Roger, please.
Thanks, Julie. This is Roger. I just wanted to make a note. Yeah, I'm available at this time. I can be available at this time on Thursday as well, if that works for enough of the others. It sounds like Tuesday may not work out at all since we have several people going to miss that. But I can make myself available Thursday at this time as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Roger, for confirming that. Appreciate that. Kathy, please.
Sorry, old hand.
Okay. Okay, and I see some people are saying they can do Thursday. So staff will take the action following this call to just very quickly send a message to the list asking if people are able to attend on Thursday. If we can get enough people who say they're able to attend, then we will schedule the next call for Thursday at the same time. And Kathy, I still see a hand there. Is that still an old hand?
Still an old hand. This is so much fun learning new systems.
That's all right. I'll lower it for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great.
You're welcome. It's now lowered. Thank you very much, everyone. And that took a little longer than I thought. Apologies. Let me go ahead then to agenda item 3 and to Roger, please. Thank you very much, Roger.
Thanks, Julie. This is Roger. All right, let's go ahead and jump in. I don't know how much time this will take us. I think we've discussed question one quite a bit. As far as I don't want to read this whole thing, but I do want to start with the answers before we get into the recommendation. So for both Q1 A and B, we have somewhat agreed on the fact that it's probably doing both of these things. It's just that the data doesn't push us to either one of those conclusions. So I think that the way staff has this written is pretty good and that's possibly having this effect. So I'll open it up for any questions, comments on answering of question 1A or 1B. I think I'll take silence as everyone agrees with how staff answered that then. And we can move on to the recommendation. And I'll read this out so everybody can hear it at least. The subteam recommends that the language of the trademark claims notice be revised in accordance with the implementation guidance outlined in the subteam's recommendation for question 3 below. So we're creating a little bit of a circle here, but I think that it works out well as question 3 does lead itself to providing our answer here. So, and I see a hand up. Go ahead, please. Is that Michael?
Yeah, is that working now?
Yes, that sounds great.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I actually raised my hand, wanted to raise it on the Q1A
okay.
Answer. I mean, is possibly, I think the data that I've seen and anecdotal evidence and my own evidence as a practitioner, isn't that it is possibly, but that it appears to be having its intended effect on that regard. I can't say anything in terms of the response on unintended effects because I have not seen those, and I agree that the data doesn't support one way or the other, but I'm just a bit concerned about the is possibly is very vague sort of language, and I think we've seen more that whether it is over effective or not, that we have had evidence, and again, anecdotal and experiential evidence, that it has been working and has had its intended effect. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. Kathy, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Yes, please. Is Rebecca on the call?
I don't see Rebecca on the call.
Hello?
Rebecca?
Hello? Hi.
Okay, Rebecca, I was going to channel you, but go ahead, please.
Okay. So I'd like to get on the queue, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so, I mean, we've rehearsed this an awful lot. The anecdotal evidence is actually not evidence of, you know, cyber squatters being deterred. We've gone through this in pretty extensive detail. We have large-scale evidence that doesn't show any effect, which is, even if it is, even if the result is negative, it's more probative than non-representative anecdotes. It's large-scale evidence, possible is as far as the evidence will take us. And I think I'm willing to leave it there, even though there's a good argument that there's actually no effect on the kind of behavior we want to see deterred. But if we're just going to go in. Exercise is pointless. We did collect a bunch of data. It didn't show what people hoped it would show. What we've got. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca. Kathy, did you have any follow-up comment you wanted to put on that?
Yeah, just agreeing with that and that this is, I think, the compromise position we arrived at after a lot of discussion and debate. Thanks.
Thanks,
and I will
Kathy.
Try to figure out how to put my hand up.
Thanks, Kathy. All right, Christine, you have your hand up.
Hi, please, thanks. This is Christine Dorain. So I wanted to support what Michael Graham said, because I think if you look, I'm going to invite people who can affirmatively answer question 1A themselves to get in the queue. But I can tell you with 100% certainty, because of my experience, that the Trademark Claims Service is deterring bad faith registrations. And we see that, we know that, we get claims notices, we have seen instances of it working. We don't know the effect. I think that's right. There's insufficient data to know the extent of the deterrence, but we know it's working. And we don't have to actually rely on outside data to make that analysis. I think, we went to look for it to see if we could find any news stories or any interesting information that we didn't already know. And certainly we had to go looking for unintended consequences because we don't, in our group, we don't have very many examples of that. So we had to go looking for that. So I think it is fair to say that we know that the claim service is working because we see it working, but we don't know for sure how much because we don't have hard data. So I actually support Michael's position on this. Thanks.
So, Christine, this
Rebecca
is Rod, right?
Can I get on the queue again?
Yes, Rebecca. Thank you. Christine, I just wanted to follow up. So, do you have a strong disagreement with the use of possibly then?
Yeah, this is Christine. I support Michael's characterization. And I think his suggestion was, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the Trademark Claims Service appears to be, as is a soft version of saying it, but we know it does deter bad faith registrations. The question is, to what extent? We can't, we don't have data to quantify. And I think that I would accept Michael's friendly amendment there to clarify that this specific group has insight, and we know the answer to this question. The other question, we don't know the answer to as much.
Great. Thanks, Christine. Phil, you had your hand up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. And Phil here, for the record, speaking in a personal capacity, but my full working group co-chair hat is half on with the aim of moving things along to getting to decisions, and half off as I'm expressing a personal view. But while I respect the dialogue that's taken place, I think the limited time we have would be better spent not debating whether or not the word possibly should be in this answer, which is only going to be background material in an initial report, but in discussing what our recommendation is going to be. And unfortunately, we can't scroll through this document to see what would be in accordance with the sub-team recommendation for question three. But, you know, there's general consensus that it's likely deterring bad faith registrations, but we don't know the full extent. It's likely deterring good faith registrations. We don't know the full extent. To the extent that the warning deters a person not well versed in trademark law who doesn't mean to infringe but might wind up getting hit by a UDRP or URS, it's probably saving them a lot of grief. But all of that's kind of besides the point. I hope we can move rather quickly from debating these answers, which are not really what our work is about right now, but in discussing what our recommendation is going to be. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Phil. Before I jump to Greg, I think Rebecca had her hand up virtually. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Thank you. Rebecca Tushnet. So I want to just point out there's actually not consensus that it's probably working, and that's kind of the point I've been making a lot. So possible is an acceptable characterization of the data. I actually want to make a serious question, because we have had trouble getting participation on the mailing list. So Christine and Michael, I would really like to see the evidence, you know, developed over this period of actual deterrence of cyber squatters, that is bad faith registrants. So I understand that you may have had encounters with people who were unsure about how to proceed having received this notice. But the characterization of the data that you've given, including anecdotal reports, doesn't really match. So if you talk to cyber squatters, then by all means, please point to that in the in the materials. We spent a long time developing, you know, we had a lot of fights over who would get to put what in. We extended the time. So, you know, let's talk about where that evidence is. And, you know, if you would just answer on the mailing list, I would appreciate it, because I am not seeing it. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca. And I think that's a good call, Rebecca, is and going back to Phil's thing, comment is, I think that's a great place to take this up. If we can get some more information out on the mailing list, that may be the best place to discuss. But we'll go ahead and finish this discussion up real quick. Greg, please go ahead.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. I disagree with Phil to some extent in that I think that the answers are important. And I think that, you know, the way these two answers are phrased in parallel, I think, creates a series of impressions or findings that I disagree with. I don't think it's supported by the information and data that we have. I think that the question of whether it's having its intended effect of deterring us, bad faith registrations is not the only question of, talking to cyber squatters. And I'm not sure anybody has claimed to talk to a actual kind of professional cyber squatter who has been deterred or not deterred for that matter. As Christine notes, the evidence is more kind of in the experience over time, which I'm not sure that anybody captured. At the times that they received claims notifications and then the registrant didn't go forward. And maybe it seemed like it was part of a pattern or practice or something else might indicate that. I don't think the evidence we have shows that there is the way the second half of each one is phrased, we don't know the extent of the deterrence kind of assumes that part seems to assume that there is deterrence. That I think if it's possibly not having its unintended consequences or possibly not having its intended effect, it's not just a question of the extent, it's insufficient data to know the existence of the deterrence or the existence or the extent. And I see Kathy saying that a professional cyber squatter is by definition not deterred. I'm not so sure about that. One of the things I noted in the new GTLDs is a lot of amateurish, maybe they were trying to make money off of it, but much more amateurish cyber squatting than was traditionally noticed. And I think there were a lot of people who just, kind of thought they could make some money and do some stuff. So I guess that makes them unprofessional professional cyber squatters. Maybe they were deterred or not. I don't think we have, enough data to say much about anything, but I think that, an answer that basically kind of indicates that this is kind of an area where we have kind of an equal answer for both, or equal basis of an answer for both. I do support the idea that the data didn't show what people wanted it to, but I think that I would say that in the opposite direction. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Before I move on to Michael, I just wanted everybody to take a note of what Ariel put into the chat as well, that Q1 will be going out on the thread, the mailing list, so that we can get this actively discussed on the mailing list as well. I'm going to finish up with Michael and Cynthia, and then we can move on. Go ahead, Michael.
Thanks. Michael Graham for the record. I will try to engage on the mailing list. I will express here my frustration insofar as I do have a regular job that demands more of my attention than I might some days want. However, I will give just a very quick example on our part that supports, I think, my determination that the claims notice is having the desired effect. And that is that as in comparison with the number of UDRP proceedings and challenges that we have to make in the legacy domains, we have at this time, at least, a substantially lower number in the new GTLDs. And at the same time, I do note that we have received a number of indications of notices going out on our TMCH registered trademarks to applicants. And based on that, it appears that this claims notice is being effective in limiting or reducing or eliminating, in some cases, cyber squatting and the registration of our trademarks in some of these new GTLDs. So that's part of the evidence. In terms of asking a professional cyber squatter, I don't think you're going to get any answer there. And I'll just finish up, and I'll note this in the discussion on the mailing list, equating possibly in Q1A with the possibly in Q1B, I think that's a false equivalence, that we have not seen any evidence whatsoever specific of there being adverse effects, whereas we have seen evidence and anecdotal evidence of positive effects from the notices. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Cynthia, can you go ahead?
Yes, can you hear me? This is Cynthia.
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi there. So the idea that we are going to ask cyber squatters specifically, hey, can you tell me how many domains you're cyber squatting and whether or not a claims notice is preventing you from registering some of those names is really kind of ridiculous. So I'm not sure why we're spending so much time on that. But to the point, I do know a number of cyber squatters, and I do know that those cyber squatters are looking for easy targets. And I also know that when they receive notice that something is not going to be an easy target, they can be deterred. So the claims notice absolutely has some effect. However, as I've noted last week, the claims notice is so difficult to understand, I think that it is impossible for us to know the exact effect. So, we can debate exact, I guess we could talk about which words most clearly exemplify the situation. But, the idea that there is no evidence out there that cyber squatters are deterred is ridiculous. We can see that in people who have trademarks can see that in the overall numbers. But the idea that we're going to get cyber squatters to say, yes, let me tell you how many times I was deterred from, cyber squatting a name, doing something illegal, is kind of ridiculous. We should talk about the language and let's move on. Thank you.
Thanks, Cynthia. Yeah, and I think that we've all agreed that we can move this to the list then and we can discuss it there and we can move on to the recommendation and discuss the recommendation. Kathy, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Roger. We'll take it on the list. I think we've been in this conversation before, and we spent hours on Q1A and especially Q1B, and lots and lots of evidence of unintended consequences. Like it or not, there's a lot. We asked about it. We got answers. We got responses. So we can move it onto the list. But the same point, I agree with Cynthia and Roger. Let's go forward and let's talk about how to fix what we found that needs to be fixed, which is the notice. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Kathy. All right. This is Roger again, I guess I should say. So I did go ahead and I read the recommendation. I'll turn it over and give everybody a chance to comment, suggesting possible changes or however. Please, anyone that has any comments, come on up.
Sorry, Roger, what are we commenting on? This is Kathy.
Yes, thank you, Kathy. This is Roger. On the recommendation, I'll read it again since it's been a bit since we actually heard it. I just wanted comments on the recommendation for charter question one, which is the recommendation is the subteam recommends that the language of the trademark claim notice be revised in accordance with the implementation guidance outlined in the subteam's recommendation for question three. There you go. Thanks for the suggestions online of showing Q3. So I'll go ahead and read the guidance from Q3. I think that's what Q1 was pointing to. So I'll read the guidance and hopefully everybody's already read the recommendation. The guidance suggests or states the claims notice must be clearly comprehensible to a layperson unfamiliar with trademark law. Add any other agreed terms, concepts, parameters, objectives, and principles for the revised claim notice. May also suggest that ICANN.org consider partnering with external resources that have already indicated an interest in helping redraft the claims notice, e.g. the AUIP clinic. Greg, your hand's up, please go ahead.
Thanks. I assume we're actually still talking about question one, even if we're looking at question three.
Correct. We are talking about the recommendation on question one. As it points to question three, that's why it's being pulled up.
I think we're missing a connection between the questions in question one and the recommendation. The recommendation there does not flow without further elucidation from whatever the answers we ultimately end up with two questions 1A and question 1B. They ask, you know, directly, they don't ask directly about the content of the claims notice. So I think at the very least, one option is to just take it out of question one entirely as a recommendation. And another option is to, you know, create an actual linkage, if there is one, that says that, you know, an improvement in the verbiage of the claims notice would improve its chances of having its intended effect, because it would be understood by more people, and would decrease the chance of unintended effect, if any, because deterrence through just intimidation at receiving an impenetrable document would be mitigated. But, you know, without that, there's no connection between the question about consequences and a recommendation to change the trademark claims notice. Thanks.
This is Roger. Greg, just wanted to follow up with you. How would you create that link, more so than it already does refer to Q3 in the recommendation?
Well, I think the reference to Q3, you know, goes to does not go to the question of intended effect or unintended effect. I think the answer to some extent does, but I think I would either have the answer be more fulsome in Q3 or add to the answer in Q1. We say here in Q3A3 that the subteam generally agreed that the current level of translations of the trademark claims notice does not seem effective in informing domain name applicants. So at the very least, you know, in the reference to Q3, we would note that some feeling that the language hinders the effectiveness of the notice, and that we'd be more likely to see intended effects and less likely to see unintended effects, if any, with an improved notice. But right now, just looking at saying, look at Q3, doesn't, to my mind, provide enough guidance for how it links up to intended effect and unintended effect.
Okay, thanks, Greg. All right, Michael, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. And sort of going back to the question that you asked Greg there, I think what is needed in terms of the recommendation ahead of the reference to the revision of the notice itself is a statement that, based on the evidence, there's insufficient, or based on our analysis, there's insufficient evidence to conclude either that it is having positively having its intended effects or having unintended effects. However, we have determined that, based on the evidence and the discussions, that there should be improvement, and they want to improve the intended effect, and two, to help remove the unintended effects that we believe is happening. Something along those lines, and then that then leads into the conclusion that we would support the answer to question 3. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Phil, your hand's up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. For the record, I would suggest I'm generally okay with the current text of the recommendation that appears on page 12 of the full document answering 3A subparts 1 and 2. But I think it might be helpful, and I throw this idea out for discussion, to have an introductory sentence for further guidance of the implementation team if this recommendation goes forward and winds up in the final report and being adopted, that the aim of the revision of the language of the claims notice should be to increase the deterrence effect for those registrants who intend to infringe, while simultaneously increasing the amount of useful information for those potential registrants who don't have infringing intent so they can accurately gauge their risk of an enforcement action based on their intended use of the domain. That was too many words, but I think you get the drift of what I'm suggesting, that there be some introductory sentence which links back to question one and the answers and kind of sets up the whole purpose of the revision of the trademark claims notice language that we're recommending here. Thank you, and I hope that has some merit for other members.
Thanks, Phil. This is Roger. Okay, so I'll just take that one step and maybe even ask Greg to step up and say something about it. So that's kind of creating that link that Greg talked about, just kind of in the reverse. And I don't know if Greg has any thoughts on that.
This is Greg for the record. I think we're getting there. I think, as long as the connection can be read between the two, and I think if a little bit more can be added, perhaps in question one, as to what we're referring to in 3A, just a couple of words about effectiveness. Have to see it, but I think we're heading in the right direction of kind of trying to create, a basis or linkage between, why the answers are relevant and why the recommendations are being made. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. And I think it looks like Susan and Christine both kind of agree that linkage, and I think that now most of the people have agreed some better linkage is needed. So I think we can take that back and take a look at that and see what we can come up with. Any other comments on recommendation one? Okay, great. I think our agenda now is moving to the proposals, 5 and 6. So we'll jump into proposal 5. And this is, I'll read it out so the people that are on the phone can hear it and maybe respond as well. If the trademark claims notices are retained in, are retained, a separate proposal calls for their elimination, then registrars shall be allowed to be compensated on a cost per impression basis for the display of the mandatory notices. So the proposal is registrars could, and I don't know how this would happen, but could be compensated in some way for displaying of the notice when they need to display it. I'll open it up for comments. Kathy, your hand is up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, sure. The proponent of this proposal is not here. So let me just read a little more by way of background. And it's in front of us. Normally, a registrar would charge a third party a fee to display a message at checkout time. These messages are revenue generating. However, as we know, mandatory trademark claims do not generate revenue, but instead there's a huge abandonment rate, I'm paraphrasing, causing a loss of revenue presumably for the registrars because people are not proceeding to checkout. Furthermore, we know that some terms in the TMCH are requested more than others, hotel, love, and so by shifting the cost from the less frequently searched recordals to the more frequently searched recordals, there's greater balance in the system. I know there's going to be a lot of objection to this about to come, but it's interesting. It's an interesting idea designed to kind of address really kind of the shocking conclusion that we found in the original analysis group report, which is that most of the top 10 hits trademark claims notices generated are for common ordinary dictionary words and not any kind of terms that we would consider globally famous in the way we were thinking when we crafted these rules in 2009, 2010. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Kathy. And Christine, your hand's up. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine Doreen. So I think that I think if we fix the claims notice, we could possibly get around this idea of, well, first of all, we don't know why people abandon their checkouts. People abandon checkouts for a lot of reasons. I abandon multiple checkouts a day for a lot of reasons. But at Amazon, we have fairly detailed statistics as far as how far people get in our processes, and we're not even out of Sunrise. So we don't even, or not, we weren't still limited registration period. So there's no way to know why someone abandons. But if you fix the claims notice such that someone who wants to, let's pick hotel, for instance, someone wants to register hotel.something, they should make a reasonable choice as to whether or not they want to continue and then continue. No one needs to bear the cost of that. The person can either make a purchase or not make a purchase, but they ultimately are just confronted with a choice and having to make a decision based on a proposed cost in front of them. So I don't think that this proposal makes a lot of sense, and it isn't even viable. So thanks.
Thanks, Christine. Susan, your hand's up. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. It's Susan. I sort of was going to say what Christine wrapped up with, which is both that I can't see how this could possibly be viable. It seems to me to be an extraordinarily complex thing that would have to be introduced for each registrar to be able to be somehow reimbursed in this way. It's just not at all clear to me, you know, that there's a problem that exists that this would fix. This seems like an extraordinarily complex way to try and fix something that's a hypothetical problem. We do know that the analysis group had that particular figure, but even they were not particularly confident about it. They attempted to get further information in order to have a more robust and confident figure, and they couldn't get it. You know, we subsequently in our surveys attempted to get information that would assist. And again, we got some information, but the data was not really doing what we hoped it would do. You know, yes, we know there's some abandonment. We don't know how many of those people come back later and carry on with their purchasing decision. Certainly our surveys suggested that happens. We don't know how many of these people were just looking to recreate the TMCH by you know, checking what generates a claims notice. We don't know how many people were just sort of randomly having a trawl about to see what names were available and you know, deciding which one they finally plumped for. But you know, even if we have some people who are being deterred, that's why we're attempting to address it in another means by revising the language. And I just can't see how building some complex way of reimbursing registrars is going to fix George's perceived problem.
Great, thanks, Susan. Greg, your hand's up. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah. I would definitely call this a perceived problem at best. I think the proposal is based on a false premise of comparing an advertisement with a trademark claims notice by coyly using the word message. Although it's clearly identified is an advertisement in the parenthetical. So, you know, advertisements are revenue generating to the party putting the advertisement in. They're also revenue generating to the company that is providing the time or space for the ad, but this is not an ad. If you want to equate it with something else, maybe it's a public service announcement, but in any case, it's or a legal notice. Nobody's paying for that. It's just silly. And we have no idea whether the mandatory notices, you know, how they lead to a 93.7% abandonment rate versus any other percent abandonment rate under other circumstances. There's no control group. There's no second, you know, there's nothing to compare it to that's really, you know, an accurate or even reasonable comparison. Second to lastly, the fact that extremely common words were searched more commonly as potential applications and thus returned trademark registrations in the clearinghouse that were common words, I would not call that shocking any more than I would call any dog bites man story shocking. It would be shocking if we saw a huge number of people searching fanciful and coin trademarks, you know, looking to, you know, own Xerox.ninja, to the extent that that's even a relevant trademark anymore. That would be shocking if we saw this groundswell of people searching out, highly unique trademarks. Lastly, before we debate this further, we should probably ask the question of whether there's any traction or support for this from anyone other than the original member of the group who proposed it. And if there is no traction, we should probably not spend all the time on debating it. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Phil, your hand's up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Phil, for the record, not to pile on, and I haven't heard any support for this yet. I just wanted to state in a personal capacity, I regard this proposal as an intentionally poisoned pill proposal coming from a former member of this working group who was exceedingly clear that he wanted to sunset most, if not all, of the new TLD RPMs. The proposal raises multiple difficult questions in implementation. Who would pay the registrar? How much would they be paid? Would they be paid for all displays of claims notices? Or more properly, only for those that were deterred that would have been non-infringing? And to do that, you would need a baseline abandonment rate for that registrar, and then for the remaining registrations between the baseline and the 93.7%, you'd need some accurate way to estimate how many of those would have been indeed infringing registrations that would have been subject to dispute resolution procedures or infringement suits. So I think the intent of this proposal was to burden and perhaps kill the claims notice, and that the implementation would be extremely difficult, if not impossible. And I concur with Greg that unless we hear significant support for it, we should check the box and say that it's not accepted. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And I'll agree with the last two speakers saying that I haven't heard any responses supporting this. I want to ask Ariel or Julie if we have answered the question so that we can process this and say that we are done with this one.
This is Ariel from staff. I think we have heard sufficient feedback from the call, so I think staff can take a first stab at the draft answers to this proposal and then perhaps share that via the discussion thread. So just a quick summary, I think what we heard is the proposal will not be put forward to the full working group to consider for inclusion in the initial report. That's our rough understanding of the discussion.
Great, thanks Ariel. And I would concur with how you stated that. Okay, I think we can retire this proposal. Julie, Ariel, do we want to try to tackle proposal 6 or are we running out of time?
This is Ariel again. Sorry, I cannot raise my hand. So I think for proposal 6, maybe we can move it to the next call and then perhaps we can wrap up and just let the sub-team know the homework before next call.
Okay, that sounds good. Any comments or questions from the group before staff closes us out? Yes, can you just pop proposal 6 up on the screen so they can take a quick look at it? There we go. And I will turn it back over. Oh, sorry, Susan, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry about this. And really, it was just about Proposal 6. I think, not to put you on the spot now, Roger, but it would be super helpful to know what you and some of the Open Registrar colleagues think of this proposal, because it's one which is proposing that sort of software be made available to registrars in order to assist them in operating the claims. And so it would be one where it would be really helpful to know if actually registrars even want this before we spend a huge amount of time giving them something that ICANN would have to create if they don't want it. So maybe I've just given you some homework, sorry.
No, thanks, Susan. And again, I'll take my hat off here and say I know the larger registrars would not use this. I can't speak for the smaller registrars. I talk to a lot of them often, and I can't imagine that they would take this and use it or not. But I can't say that for sure for all of them. My guess is no, they would. Most of them would not use it. Some would. So, and actually, I've asked staff to see if this is actually something that's been done previously, if ICANN's ever provided this up. So I'll leave it there and turn this back over to staff to follow up. Julie, please go ahead.
Sorry, this is Julie Hedlund from staff, and I was muted. and just to respond, staff is checking internally to see if there already have been anything that ICANN org has done to assist in the integration of the TM claims notices with registrar systems. So we are checking on that. And then just in this last minute, again, a reminder of the staff action to go on the list and see if there are any objections to moving the call to the same time on the 2nd of May. So we will do that as a follow-up. You'll see that just a bit later today. And I want to thank you all for joining. Thank you very much, Roger, for chairing. And we'll let you go now and adjourn this call so those who are on the next call can transition. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Meeting has been adjourned. Have a great day, all.